so much time to elapse since his last letter, he expressed himself with such extreme politeness that I almost felt I was the one who ought to apologize.
I have been wanting to tell you another part of my story, and have thought for months about writing to you. But many things have come up to prevent me from sitting at my desk and taking pen in hand. Now, almost without my realizing it, the year has nearly run its course. I am growing old, however, and could die at any moment. I can't postpone the task indefinitely. This letter might be a long one. Not too long for you, I hope, Mr. O'Connor. When I delivered Mr. Hunter's memento to you last summer, I told you a long story about my time in Mongolia. But in fact, there is even more to tell. A sequel, as it were. There were several reasons for not including this part when I told you my story last year. First of all, it would have made the tale too long if I had related it in its entirety. You may recall that I had some pressing business, and there simply wasn't time for me to tell you everything. Perhaps more important, I was still not emotionally prepared then to tell the rest of my story to anyone, to relate it fully and honestly. After I left you, however, I realized that I should not have allowed practical matters to stand in the way. I should have told you everything to the very end, without concealment. I took a machine gun bullet during the fierce battle of August 13, 1945, on the outskirts of Hai La, and as I lay on the ground, I lost my left hand under the tracks of a Soviet T-34 tank. They transferred me, unconscious, to the Soviet military hospital in Chita, where the surgeons managed to save my life. As I mentioned before, I had been attached to the Military Survey Corps of the Kwantung Army General Staff in Xinjiang, which had been scheduled to withdraw to the rear as soon as the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. Determined to die, however, I had myself transferred to the Hai La unit near the border, where I offered myself up as cannon fodder, attacking a Soviet tank with a landmine in my arms. As Mr. Honda had prophesied on the banks of the Kalka River, however, I was not able to die so easily. I lost only my hand, not my life. All the men under my command were, I believe, killed. We may have been acting under orders, but it was a stupid, suicidal attack. Our little portable mines couldn't have done a thing to a huge T-34. The only reason the Soviet army took such good care of me was that as I lay delirious, I said something in Russian. Or so they told me afterwards. I had studied basic Russian, as I have mentioned to you, and my post in the Xinjiang General Staff Office gave me so much spare time, I used it to polish what I knew. I worked hard, so that by the time the war was winding down, I could carry on a fluent conversation in Russian. Many white Russians lived in Xinjiang, and I knew a few Russian waitresses, so I was never at a loss for people to practice on. My Russian seems to have slipped out quite naturally while I was unconscious. The Soviet army was planning from the outset to send to Siberia any Japanese prisoners of war they took in occupying Manchuria, to use them as forced laborers, as they had done with German soldiers after the fighting ended in Europe. The Soviets may have been on the winning side, but their economy was in a critical state after the long war, and the shortage of workers was a problem everywhere. Securing an adult male workforce in the form of prisoners of war was one of their top priorities. For this, they would need interpreters, and the number of these was severely limited.